Our colleagues complain that by affording any president's nominees a simple up or down vote, we're trying to stifle the right to debate. Well, I think it's worth noting that we've devoted 20 days to the Owen nomination. So this is not about curtailing debating rights. This is about using the filibuster to kill nominations with which the minority disagrees.
The Senator will suspend. The Senate is not in order. The Senate will come to order so the gentleman from Kentucky can be heard. The Senator from Kentucky.
So, Mr. President, this is not about curtailing debating rights. It's about using the filibuster to simply kill nominations with which the minority disagrees so that 41 senators can dictate to the President whom he can nominate to the courts of appeals and to the Supreme Court. If there's any doubt about this, I would remind our colleagues that last year the distinguished minority leader said, there is not enough time in the universe, not enough time in the universe for the Senate to allow an up or down vote on the Owen nomination. So we should stop pretending that this debate is simply about preserving debating prerogatives. It's clearly about killing nominations. Our debate is about restoring the practice, honored for 214 years here in the Senate, of having up or down votes on judicial nominees. Never before has a minority of senators obstructed a judicial nominee who enjoyed clear majority support. Our friends on the other side of the aisle recite a list of nominees on whom there were cloture votes. But the problem with their assertion that these nominees were filibustered is that the name of each of these nominees is now preceded by the title judge, meaning, of course, they were confirmed. So what my Democratic colleagues did last Congress is indeed unprecedented. Even with controversial nominees, the leaders of both parties historically have worked together to afford them the courtesy of an up or down vote. When he was minority leader, Senator Byrd worked with Majority Leader Howard Baker to afford nominees an up or down vote, even when they did not have a supermajority. Nominees like J. Harvey Wilkinson, Alex Kaczynski, Sidney Fitzwater, and Daniel Mannion. As Senator Byrd knows, it is not easy being the majority or minority leader. Senator Byrd could have filibustered every one of those nominations, but he did not. Instead, he chose to exercise principled and restrained leadership of the Democratic caucus when he was minority leader. And I'd like to compliment Senator Byrd for that decision. Affording controversial judicial nominees the dignity of an up or down vote did not stop, however, with Senator Byrd. It was true as recently as 2000, when Senator Lott worked to stop senators on our side of the aisle, the Republican side, who sought to filibuster the Paez and Bergeon nominations. But in 2001, as the New York Times has reported, our Democratic colleagues decided to change the Senate's ground rules. A media report they have yet to deny. Just 2 years later, after they had lost control of the Senate, our Democratic colleagues began to filibuster qualified judicial nominees who enjoyed clear majority support here in the Senate. They did so on a repeated, partisan, and systematic basis. After 214 years of precedent, in a span of a mere 16 months, they filibustered 10 circuit court nominees, totally without precedent. Now, many of these nominees would fill vacancies that the administrative offices of the courts have designated as judicial emergencies, including several to the long-suffering Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in which my state is located. As a result, President Bush has the lowest percentage of circuit court nominees confirmed in modern history, a paltry 69%. The Senate, as we all know, works not just through the application of its written rules, but through the shared observance of well-settled traditions and practices. There are a lot of things one can do to gum up the works here in the Senate. A lot of things you could do. But what typically happens is we exercise self-restraint, and we don't engage in that kind of behavior because invoking certain obstructionist tactics would upset the Senate's unwritten rules. Filibustering judicial nominees with majority support falls in that category. Let me repeat, it could have always been done. For 214 years, we could have done it, but we didn't. We could have, but we didn't. By filibustering 10 qualified judicial nominees in only 16 months, our Democratic colleagues have broken this unwritten rule. This is not the first time a minority of senators has upset a Senate tradition or practice. And the current Senate majority intends to do what the majority in the Senate has often done, use its constitutional authority under Article 1, Section 5, to reform Senate procedure by a simple majority vote. Despite the incredulous protestations of our Democratic colleagues, the Senate has repeatedly adjusted its rules as circumstances dictate. The first Senate adopted its rules by majority vote. Rules, I might add, which specifically provided a means to end debate instantly by a simple majority vote. That was the first Senate way back at the beginning of our country. That was Senate Rule 8, the ability to move to the previous question and end debate. Now, two decades later, early in the 1800s, the possibility of a filibuster arose through inadvertence. The Senate's failure to renew Senate Rule 8 in 1806 on the grounds that the Senate had hardly ever needed to use it in the first place. Now, in 1917, the Senate adopted its first restraint on filibuster, its first cloture rule. That is, a means for stopping debate after Senator Thomas Walsh, a Democrat from Montana, forced the Senate to consider invoking its authority under Article 1, Section 5 to simply change Senate procedure. Specifically, in response to concerns that Germany was to begin unrestricted submarine warfare against American shipping, President Wilson sought to arm merchant ships so they could defend themselves. The legislation became known as the Armed Ship Bill. However, 11 senators who wanted to avoid American involvement in the First World War filibustered the bill. Think about this. In 1917, there was no cloture rule at all. The Senate functioned entirely by unanimous consent. So how did the Senate overcome the determined opposition of 11 isolationist senators who refused to give consent to President Wilson to arm ships? How did they do it? Well, Senator Walsh made clear that the Senate would exercise its constitutional authority under Article 1, Section 5, to reform its practices by majority vote.
Mr. President, I think the Assistant Majority Leaders deserve more respect. The
Senate is not in order. The Senate will be in order. The Senator from Alabama is correct. Senator from Kentucky is recognized.
I thank the chair. So, Mr. President, Senator Walsh made clear that the Senate would exercise its constitutional authority under Article 1, Section 5 to reform its practices by a simple majority vote. A past Senate could not, he concluded, take away the right of a future Senate to govern itself by passing rules that tied the hands of the new Senate. He said, quote, "A majority may adopt the rules in the first place. It is preposterous to assert that they may deny future majorities the right to change them." What he said makes elementary good sense. Because Walsh made clear he was prepared to end debate by majority vote, both political parties arranged to have an up or down vote on a formal cloture rule. Senator Clinton Anderson, a Democrat from New Mexico, noted years later that Walsh won without firing a shot. And Senator Paul Douglas, a Democrat from Illinois, observed also years later that consent was given in 1917 because a minority of obstructing senators had Senator Walsh's proposal, quote, "hanging over their heads," end quote. I note that the Senate's 1970 cloture rule did not pertain to a president's nominations, nor did any senators during the debate on the adoption of the 1917 cloture rule discuss its possible application to nominations. This was not because senators wanted to preserve the right to filibuster nominees. Rather, senators did not discuss applying the cloture rule to nominations because the notion of filibustering nominations was alien to them. It never occurred to anybody that that would be done. In the middle of the 20th century, senators of both parties on a nearly biennial basis invoked Article 1, Section 5 constitutional rulemaking authority. Their efforts were born out of frustration of the repeated filibustering of civil rights legislation to protect black Americans. A minority of senators had filibustered legislation to protect black voters at the end of the 19th century. They had filibustered anti-lynching bills in 1922, 1935, and 1938, anti-poll tax bills in 1942, 1944, and 46, and anti-race discrimination bills. In 1959, Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson agreed to reduce the number required for cloture to two-thirds of senators who were present and voting because he was faced with the possibility that a majority would exercise its constitutional authority to reform Senate procedure. He knew the constitutional option was possible. Additionally, the Senate has voted four times for the proposition that the majority has the authority to change Senate procedures. For example, in 1969, senators were again trying to reduce the standard for cloture, that is, to rule to cut off debate from 67 down to 60. To shut off debate on this proposed rule change, Democratic Senator Frank Church from Idaho secured a ruling from the presiding officer, Democratic Vice President and former Senator Hubert Humphrey, that a majority could shut off debate, irrespective of the much higher cloture requirement under the standing rules. A majority of senators then voted to invoke cloture by a vote of 51 to 47, in accord with the ruling of Vice President Humphrey. This was the first time the Senate voted in favor of a simple majority procedure to end debate. The Senate reversed Vice President Humphrey's ruling on appeal, but as Senator Kennedy later noted, this subsequent vote only cemented the principle that a simple majority could determine the Senate's rules. Senator Kennedy said, and these are Senator Kennedy's words, "Although Vice President Humphrey's ruling may have been reversed, the reversal was accomplished by a majority of the Senate. In other words, majority rule prevailed on the issue of the Senate's power to change its rules." Senator Kennedy made this observation in 1975, when reformers were still trying to reduce the level for cloture from 67 down to 60. Reformers had been thwarted in their effort to lower this standard for several years. In 1975, once again, Senate Democrats asserted the constitutional authority of the majority to determine Senate procedure in order to ensure an up or down vote. The Senate eventually adopted a 3/5 cloture rule, that is, 60 votes to cut off debate, but only after the Senate had voted on three separate occasions in favor of the principle that a simple majority could end debate. They had voted on three separate occasions that a simple majority could end debate, after which there was a compromise establishing the level at 60. The chief proponent of this principle was former Democratic Senator Walter Mondale, and four current Democratic senators voted in favor of it: Senator Biden, Senator Leahy, Senator Kennedy, and Senator Inouye. Indeed, Senator Kennedy was an especially forceful adherent to the constitutional authority of the Senate majority to govern, a mere majority. He asked, "By what logic can the Senate of 1917 or 1949 bind the Senate of 1975? That was Senator Kennedy. He then echoed Senator Walsh's observation from almost 60 years earlier. Quote, "A majority may adopt the rules in the first place. It is preposterous to assert that they may deny to later majorities the right to change them." Finally, referring to unanimous consent constraints that faced the Senate in 1917, Senator Kennedy made an astute observation as to why a majority of the Senate had to have rulemaking authority. Senator Kennedy said, surely no one would claim that a rule adopted by one Senate prohibiting changes in the rules except by unanimous consent could be binding on a future Senate. If not, then why should one Senate be able to bind future Senates to a rule that such change can be made only by two-thirds vote? Recently, the authority to which I've been referring has been called the constitutional option, or the pejorative term, nuclear option. But while the authority of the majority to determine Senate procedures has long been recognized, most often in Senate history by our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, incidentally, it was the senior senator from West Virginia who employed this constitutional authority most recently, most effectively, and most frequently. Senator Byrd employed the constitutional option four times in the late 70s and 80s. The context varied, but three common elements were present each time. First, there was a change in Senate procedure through a point of order rather than through a textual change to Senate rules. Second, the change was achieved through a simple majority vote. And third, the change in procedure curtailed the options of senators, including their ability to mount different types of filibusters or otherwise pursue minority rights. Senator Byrd, on four occasions, as majority leader. The first time Senator Byrd employed the constitutional option was in 1977 to eliminate post-cloture filibuster by amendment. Senate Rule 22 provides once cloture is invoked, each member is limited to 1 hour of debate, and it prohibits dilatory and non-germane amendments. But because Democratic Senators Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio and James Abrisk of South Dakota opposed deregulating natural gas prices, they used existing Senate procedures to delay passage of a bill that would have done so after cloture had been invoked. They stalled debate by repeatedly offering amendments without debating them, thereby delaying the post-cloture clock. If points of order were made against the amendments, they simply appeal the ruling of the chair, which was debatable. And if there were a motion to table the appeal, then there would have to be roll call votes. Neither of these options would consume any post-cloture time. After 13 days of filibustering by amendment, the Senate had suffered through, now listen to this, 121 roll call votes and endured 34 live quorums with no end in sight. Under then existing precedent, the presiding officer had to wait for a senator to make a point of order before ruling an amendment out of order. By creating a precedent, Senator Byrd changed that procedure. He enlisted the aid of Vice President Walter Mondale as presiding officer and made a point of order that the presiding officer now had to take the initiative to rule amendments out of order that the chair deemed dilatory. Vice President Mondale sustained Senator Byrd's new point of order. Senator Abrisk appealed, but his appeal was tabled by a majority vote. The use of this constitutional option set a new precedent. It allowed the presiding officer to rule amendments out of order to crush post-cloture filibusters. With this new precedent in hand, Senator Byrd began calling up amendments, and Vice President Mondale began ruling them out of order. With Vice President Mondale's help, Senator Byrd disposed of 33 amendments, making short work of the Metzenbaum-Abrisk filibuster. Now, years later, Senator Byrd discussed how he created new precedent to break this filibuster chart, to break this filibuster. This is what Senator Byrd said years later about what he did. He said, I've seen filibusters. I've helped to break them. There are a few senators in this body who were here when I broke the filibuster on the natural gas bill. I asked Mr. Mondale, the vice president, to go please sit in the chair. I wanted to make some points of order and create some new precedents that would break these filibusters. And the filibuster was broken. Back, neck, legs, and arms. Back, neck, legs, and arms. It went away in 12 hours. So I know something about filibusters. I helped to set a great many of the precedents that are in the books here. That's Senator Byrd on his effort, one of his efforts, involving the use of the constitutional option. Although Senator Byrd acted within his rights, his actions were certainly controversial. His Democratic colleague, Senator Aberesk, complained that Senator Byrd had changed the entire rules of the Senate during the heat of the debate on a majority vote. And according to Senator Byrd's own History of the Senate, the book that he wrote that we all admire so greatly, in Senator Byrd's own History of the Senate, he and Vice President Mondale were severely criticized for the extraordinary actions we had taken to break the post-cloture filibusters. Now, some might argue that in 1977, Senator Byrd was not subscribing to the constitutional option. However, the procedure he employed, making a point of order, securing a ruling from the chair, and tabling the appeal by a simple majority vote, is the same procedure the current Senate majority may use. Moreover, 15 months later, Senator Byrd expressly embraced the Senate majority's rulemaking authority. Back in January of 1979, Majority Leader Byrd proposed a Senate rule to greatly reform debate procedure. His proposed rules change might have been filibustered, so he reserved the right to use the constitutional option. Here's what he said. He said, "I base this resolution on Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution. There is no higher law, insofar as our government is concerned, than the Constitution. The Senate rules are subordinate to the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution in Article 1, Section 5 says that each house shall determine the rules of its proceedings. Congress is not obliged to be bound by the dead hand of the past." By the dead hand of the past. Senator Byrd did not come to his conclusion lightly. In fact, in 1975, he had argued against the constitutional option. But faced with a filibuster in 1979, he said he had simply changed his mind. And this is what he had to say. "I've not always taken that position, but I take it today in light of recent bitter experience. So I say to senators again that the time has come to change the rules. I want to change them in an orderly fashion. I want a time agreement." He went on to say, "But barring that, if I have to be forced into a corner to try for majority vote, I will do it because I'm going to do my duty as I see my duty, whether I win or lose. If we can only change an abominable rule by majority vote, that is in the interest of the Senate and in the interest of the nation, that the majority must work its will, and it will work its will." Now, Senator Byrd did not have to use the constitutional option in early 1979 because the Senate relented under the looming threat and agreed to consider his proposed rule change through regular order. As another example, in 1980, Senator Byrd created a new precedent that is the most applicable, Mr. President, the most applicable to the current dispute here in the Senate. This use of the constitutional option eliminated the possibility that one could filibuster a motion to proceed to a nomination. Let me say that again. We're on a nomination now, Mr. President, on the executive calendar. The reason it was not possible to filibuster a motion to proceed to that nomination, we can thank to Senator Byrd in 1980 when he exercised the constitutional option to simply get rid of the ability to filibuster a motion to proceed to an item on the executive calendar. Before March of 1980, reaching a nomination required two separate motions. A non-debatable motion to proceed to executive session, which could not be filibustered and which would put the Senate on its first treaty on the calendar, and a second debatable motion to proceed to a particular nominee, which could be filibustered. Now, Senator Byrd changed this precedent by conflating these two motions, one of which was debatable, into one non-debatable motion. Specifically, he made a motion to go directly into executive session to consider the first nominee on the calendar. Senator Jesse Helms made a point of order that this was improper. Under Senate precedent, a person could not use a non-debatable motion to specify the business he wanted to conduct on the executive calendar. The presiding officer sustained Senator Helms' point of order as being correct under Senate rules and precedents. In a party-line vote, Senator Byrd overturned the ruling on appeal. And because of this change in precedent, it effectively is no longer possible to filibuster the motion to proceed to a nominee. So, Mr. President, where are we? There are other examples where our distinguished colleague used the Senate's authority to reform its procedures by a simple majority vote. We on this side of the aisle may have to employ the same procedure in order to restore the practice of affording judicial nominees an up or down vote. We did not cavalierly decide to use the constitutional option. Like Senator Byrd in 1979, we arrived at this point after recent bitter experience, to quote Senator Byrd, and only after numerous attempts to resolve this problem through other means had failed. Here's all we've done, Mr. President, in recent times to restore up or down votes for judges. We've offered generous unanimous consent requests. We've had weeks of debate. In fact, we spent 20 days on the current nominee. The majority leader offered the Frist-Miller rule compromise. All of these now rejected. The Specter protocols, which would guarantee that nominations were not bottled up in committee. That was offered by the majority leader. That was rejected. Negotiations with the new leader, Senator Reid, hoping to change the practice from the previous leadership in the previous Congress. That was rejected. The Frist of Fairness Rule compromise. All of these, Mr. President, rejected. Now, unfortunately, none of these efforts have, at least as of this moment, borne any fruit. Our Democratic colleagues seem intent on changing the ground rules, as the New York Times laid it out in 2002. They want to change the ground rules, as they did in the previous Congress, in how we treat judicial nominations. We are intent on going back to the way the Senate operated quite comfortably for 214 years. There were occasional filibusters, but cloture was filed, and on every occasion where the nominee enjoyed majority support in the Senate, cloture was invoked. We'll have an opportunity to do that in the morning with cloture on Priscilla Owen. Colleagues on both sides of the aisle who want to defuse this controversy have a way to do it in the morning, and that is to do what we did for 214 years. If there was a controversial nominee, cloture was filed, cloture was invoked, and that controversial nominee got an up or down vote. Mr. President, I yield the floor.